It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, Special Counsel Robert Mueller's statement last week raised questions about future charges against President Trump. We'll find out what the legal system says about prosecutions of ex-presidents. First, how productive have you been today? Did you accomplish a lot and make the most optimal use of your time? What if you completely rethought your idea of what it means to be productive? And instead of dividing your attention among hundreds of different tasks, how about trying actively to do nothing, or at least nothing you think of as productive? Our next guest says we need to take a closer look at the way we use our time and think about our time and push back against the constant pressure to do something. Jenny Odell is an artist and writer who teaches art and digital physical design at Stanford University. She's the author of How to Do Nothing, Resisting the Attention Economy. Jenny, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks so much for having me.
Well, when I picture doing nothing, I picture, you know, sitting and staring off. That's not exactly what you're looking for. There's a lot of something to your nothing, it seems like. Can you tell us about that?
Sure. So I think, you know, the sort of figure of doing nothing can encompass a lot of things, as long as it's something that's, you know, more on the observational or kind of receptive side of things, as opposed to needing to have a knee-jerk reaction or, you know, a supposed grasp of everything that you're seeing in front of you. Even the kind of most stereotypical form of doing nothing that I personally do, which is sitting at a bench at a rose garden staring into space. If you're in a place like that, I mean, staring into space is actually quite a full experience. I mean, there are all kinds of things there. There's, you know, plants and animals and people doing all different kinds of things. I mean, it literally changes minute to minute. So, you know, doing nothing doesn't necessarily mean like seeing nothing or thinking nothing or not being surprised by anything. It's just a kind of stillness and openness as opposed to this kind of traditional understanding of productivity.
And you're worried about this idea of a constant pressure to be productive, the attention economy that wants us to be doing something all the time. Talk a little more about what you're trying to get away from, at least a little bit.
I think maybe the best way to describe it is I'm kind of pushing against this idea of optimization, this idea that everything is a product and everything can be optimized. So I think a lot of the times we're sold the idea of ourselves or our lives as products that can be, you know, optimized, that can perform better, that can be constantly improved. And I don't have a problem with the idea of self-improvement, but I think there are forms of it where, you know, you're imagining that there's kind of like a point in space type of goal that you should orient everything in your life toward. And anything that doesn't kind of fall into that category is not worth your time. It becomes expensive if time is money. And I think, you know, there's a lot of reasons that's problematic. I think it kind of corrals your attention unnaturally. It means that you are not open to surprise. And if you think about a lot of the most meaningful moments in your life are often ones in which you are surprised or you're kind of straying from that really narrow path. So I think I'm trying to kind of widen what we think of as being, you know, meaningful or productive or worthwhile by questioning how we're measuring that worth.
You have a few themes that you keep coming back to in the book that will enable us to do nothing and do it well, I guess, if that's possible. And one of those seems to be a space to do nothing in, and that takes us back to your rose garden. How can we make sure we have spaces in our world where we can do nothing and really get something out of it?
It's pretty hard. I think that space and the use of space suffers from, you know, the same things that define how we think about our time. So, you know, park is something that is similarly not really productive, right? In an obvious way, it's not making money. There's not really any obvious way to quote unquote use a park. And the things that happen in a park are similarly not so easily defined. And so I think there's this kind of constant pressure from the outside of these kinds of spaces to appropriate them to something a little bit more supposedly productive. So parks and libraries and these kind of non-commercial spaces become, you know, a really important place, you know, just sort of an image of a bubble of unproductivity, but also those are the spaces where you go to be able to do something like that.
Talking to Jenny Odell about her new book, How to Do Nothing, Resisting the Attention Economy. That space, time, is an obvious big part of your book. And it seems like in a lot of ways, our time keeps getting colonized by work. If you have some kinds of jobs, you can keep working, doing email, texting, whatever, anywhere in the world. If you're in a service job, you might be on call all the time. Have we lost the ability to just say, hey, this is not work time at all?
It seems that way increasingly. And I have to say that, you know, I acknowledge that there are a lot of folks for whom, like, this is just sort of a reality, right? Like, there are some people who don't have the choice of whether or not they're sort of on call all the time. For instance, someone who works in the gig economy or someone who works, you know, more than one job without benefits. So for me, it's very much tied to the decline of job security and benefits. But I think even for those of us who could potentially think of part of our days as not work, it becomes harder because even things like representing your leisure time on something like Instagram feels like a kind of work in a way. It's sort of like everything is potentially part of your personal brand. I think it just becomes harder and harder to imagine truly off time, like time that doesn't achieve anything, that you have nothing to show for. So I think it's definitely something that's gotten harder. And one of the things that I mentioned in the book is when I worked for a couple years at a corporate job, and they instituted this thing called the results-only work environment, which is supposed to be sort of a flexible work schedule. There's no 9-to-5 as long as you get your work done. Doesn't really matter when or where. And I didn't have a smartphone at the time, and I held off on getting one because I realized that the combination of that system with having a smartphone and email means that you're essentially on call all the time. So on the one hand, you have more freedom because you can structure your workday how you need to. On the other hand, you have less freedom because you're always potentially reachable.
Now, you're always looking for ways to do nothing and do it well. And one of your methods seems to involve birds a lot. Can you tell us about the birds in your life?
Sure. I actually just saw some about 20 minutes ago of my bird friends. There's a bunch of crows that live in my neighborhood. And a couple of years ago, I read a book about how crows are incredibly intelligent. They're some of the most, you know, intelligent by our standards of intelligence, of course. Some of the smartest animals, and they recognize human faces and can remember, you know, individual humans, for good or for bad, depending on how you interacted with them. So, I've sort of befriended a couple of crows that now come to my balcony every morning. And so that was kind of a really pivotal moment for me, just in terms of thinking about what it means to be recognized by essentially a wild animal and thinking about what they see when they look at me, this kind of human that emerges reliably from this small box every day. And that they don't see, you know, they don't see my career, they don't see progress, they don't, you know, see any of that stuff. They just see kind of a recurrence, and they see me as the animal that I am. So I enjoy, you know, and I look at other birds besides crows. Obviously, I'm really into bird watching, but in general, I think the reason I enjoy, you know, observing birds is because they're unpredictable. They kind of show up out of nowhere because I'm always learning new things about them. So I'm constantly being surprised. But I think it's also more fundamentally a reminder to me that I, you know, am an earthly being, and I inhabit this place with other beings that are sensing the same kind of world that I'm in.
Well, and it seems like the way you talk about birds, looking at the world through a bird's eye view, I guess, if you will, it's a way to shake up the way you perceive the world. You see art having a value in doing that, too. Finding ways to step outside our usual frame and just see the world from a different angle.
Yeah, absolutely. I think my favorite art to, you know, spend time with, and also the art that I try to make, very much falls into this category of just, you know, even slightly shifting one's perspective. Ever since I was a kid, I always enjoyed the moment of taking off in a plane and looking down and seeing your familiar surroundings, you know, suddenly rendered alien. And you have this moment of realizing how specific and fragile the human environment is, which is not, I think, something that's easy to think about when you're just walking the same route every day, kind of on the ground. And I've also always been obsessed with microscope images for the same reason, where, you know, you might be looking at your own skin and it's this, again, alien landscape. So I think these kinds of like zooming in and zooming out or kind of changing perspective. Of course, thinking about what animals see is one way of doing that. I think that is really effective for me in kind of getting outside of this really kind of frozen, myopic, short attention span loop that I'm in a lot of the time, especially, you know, on something like social media, but really just in general.
We're talking to Jenny Odell. She's an artist and writer who teaches at Stanford University. She's the author of her new book, How to Do Nothing, Resisting the Attention Economy. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What do you think about this concept of doing nothing? Do you have something like that that you do that allows you to maybe disconnect from the things that distract you, that take your attention all the time, every day? Something that lets you restart, step away? Do you take time to disconnect from work, the news, all those other things that compete for our attention? Do you see some benefits from doing that? And do you have a place you go to do nothing, whatever your version of nothing is? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our conversation with artist and writer Jenny Odell. Her new book is called How to Do Nothing, Resisting the Attention Economy. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have comments or questions about doing nothing and our guest's prescription for doing that? How do you define productivity in your life? Do you try to step away from those things you see as productive to do something different? Better? Change of pace? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll go to your calls now. Paul is with us in Menominee Falls. Paul, hello.
Hi. Thanks for the show. Thanks for taking my call. I'm actually a teacher. This year I'm teaching online, and I've taught for decades. And I've watched, you know, schools are... one of the main perpetrators of making kids, of getting kids digitally addicted these days. We don't think of it that way, but they do, with assigning more and more online work. And so as a family, we are trying to de-digitize and, you know, just doing a lot of things that people, you know, are available to you. Anything from landscaping, lawn work, to going to the gym. We go out for bike rides, we walk, read books, hang out. So just trying to, you know, minimize our digital footprint as much as possible, which is hard, and it's, the schools are just pushing it on kids more and more. So thanks for the great show. Appreciate it quite a bit.
Paul, thanks a lot for calling in. Jenny, I've heard people talk about the idea of a digital fasting or a digital Sabbath. What do you think of what Paul's talking about?
I mean, I think it really highlights the importance of having other people do something like that with you. I think so much of getting caught up in something like the attention economy is not just the ways that they're designed to keep you on there, but also the fact that everyone around you is doing it. And so I think something like, you know, a family or a group of friends that has all kind of agreed to maybe try to not spend as much time, say, on their phone is really important. I also think that there's, you know, a lot of use in something like, I mean, I think in the book, I'm a little bit skeptical of the idea of digital detox as a kind of like corporate retreat often. But I think that there's a lot to be said for even just short periods of time, you know, even just going for a walk, say, without your phone, just like whatever sort of interruption you can get. I think that with the attention economy, as with anything else, stepping outside of the situation is really important for getting perspective on it. And I think it's also important to acknowledge that it's something that you will have to renegotiate, you know, maybe forever. It's something that you have to keep coming back to every day. It's not something that's going to get figured out once and for all.
Thanks a lot for the call. We'll go now to Brad in Glendale. Brad, hi.
Yes. For some years, I've been doing where I do nothing every day. And I noticed that my cat Grover would sit in the bay window right in front of our kitchen table, and he would just be staring out there, obviously looking for like a bird or something else, and I would start staring with him. And so now I will spend, not every day, but most days, I'll spend 15 or 20 minutes, and I'm just staring out the window, and I'll just see what I can see. And I'll see, you'll be surprised, as Yogi Berra says, you'll be surprised what you can see if you start looking. And, you know, so, you know, my wife will say, what are you doing? I said, I'm just grovering. I'm here with Grover, my cat, and we're just grovering, and we'll just sit there. And I see all sorts of little wildlife, and it's like, this is delightful. It's kind of like a form of meditation. And I find myself, oh, I'm relaxed now, and I'll go to work, or I'll, you know, whatever I have to do.
Brad, thank you so much for sharing that. I love that. I feel like I, and I'm probably not alone here, Jenny, would have a hard time having the patience to do something like grovering in this case. How do we get ourselves out of the, you know, I got to be doing something, got to be paying attention mode to that, hey, I'm okay staring out a window for 10 minutes?
I think actually the fact that in this case there's a cat involved is really a really important detail. I think watching and spending time with animals is actually, it makes it very easy, in my opinion. I was actually just asking my studio mate yesterday. I've become curious about what people's morning routines are right when they wake up, because I think, you know, a lot of people, and I, you know, honestly, sometimes I do this, you know, you just reach for your phone right when you wake up, which is sort of horrible, right? So I've been asking around, and I asked her what she did, and she said, you know, the first thing she does is, you know, make coffee and play with her cat. And that's, you know, that's it. That's the beginning of her day. And I was like, wow, that sounds so great. And I guess I sit on my balcony and I watch the crows. Like today I was watching this crow doing this like series of crow stretches that I didn't know that they do. And just kind of looking at the crow, looking at other things. I don't know. There's something about like spending time with another form of life that is also observing things that I think actually is quite inviting. I think makes it easier to kind of step outside of your own feeling of needing to accomplish something. I think also I'm reminded of this cat that lives in the Rose Garden. Well, it doesn't live in the Rose Garden, but it lives nearby, and it spends a lot of time in the Rose Garden, and everyone there knows this cat. And I saw it one time just kind of staring into the bushes. Clearly it was waiting for, you know, something. It was going to pounce. And I just stood there with it, and I also listened. And I found that I was able to kind of like hear really small rustlings that I maybe wouldn't otherwise be able to hear. It was like I was sort of like the cat was teaching me how to listen to in a cat way, you know. And so really, I think, spending time around or just observing animals makes it a lot easier than you would think.
Thanks for that call. We're talking to Jenny O'Dell about her new book, How to Do Nothing, Resisting the Attention Economy. It's right there in the title, resisting. You are hoping, this is kind of a call to action here. What is your call to action for people to resist the attention economy and everything that comes with it?
I sort of want this, you know, on the one hand, for the individual to have permission to, you know, rest and reflect and recognize the parts of life that are meaningful, that can't be, you know, say represented online or represented in a tweet, or can't be made into anything, to just simply recognize that. And then on the kind of, you know, next level from that, I kind of propose that if more individuals were able to do that and to recognize that, that we might take some of the energy that we spend, you know, in this obsession with the cult of productivity, not so much shouting into the void, but more kind of saying the things that we need to say to the people that we need to say them to, that it might lead to a kind of more focused form of communication, and reflection, and things like, seeking context, which takes a lot of time and patience and is not necessarily encouraged by something like social media. So I do think that, you know, ideally it could also have an effect, on the level of, say, like a community or a movement or something like that. But, you know, really the book is coming from my individual point of view and addressed to an individual, and it's very open-ended. It's not a self-help book. There's a lot of food for thought, but it's sort of up to the reader what they end up doing with it. It's more that I'm sort of trying to clear the grounds or create conditions for a certain type of thought.
You do write about movements, individuals, groups who have tried to withdraw in one way or the other, whether that's a back to the land commune or what have you. It doesn't feel like that's where you want to go. You're looking for not stopping connections, but finding better connections with each other.
Yeah, exactly. There's a reason that chapter about the communes in the 60s comes after my first chapter, in which I kind of describe the crisis that I at least was having, particularly in late 2016. And the reason that chapter comes next is it's kind of like me blocking the exits. Like, you just read about this, you know, you have this feeling of wanting to kind of throw your phone out the window and move to the woods. And then I'm sort of like, okay, let's look at the equivalent of something like that. And where does that actually lead? And so I end up sort of coming back around to this idea of still participating, but participating in a different way, and not asking, you know, whether to participate, but how, in a way that is more meaningful, that doesn't sort of drive you insane. And if that means, you know, stepping away now and then, even just conceptually, if you can't actually, you know, get out of a situation, conceptually trying to remove oneself or get a different perspective, but then come back and use that perspective in the world to do the things that need to be done. That's kind of the balance that I'm trying to strike.
Do you, after thinking about this a lot and now talking about it and writing about it a lot, do you now find it easy to take these times to do nothing? Or do you, even you, after going through all this, still feel that pressure that you should be doing something else?
I still definitely feel the pressure. I think if anything has resulted from writing the book, I recognize the extent to which things are designed to make that difficult for me. And I also have a deeper appreciation for, you know, for doing nothing. I mean, I am always blown away by, you know, periods of time where I haven't, you know, gone on any long walks or done any of the things that I would normally like to do. And then I sort of mysteriously become miserable without thinking about why. And then, you know, and then finally I'll go on, say, like a several hour walk and feel like, you know, I can actually think and breathe again. I mean, it's really like I can't even describe the difference. And so I think I've just become more aware of the importance and how much is arrayed against me in my seeking those activities.
It's a good place to leave it. Jenny, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you.
That's Jenny Odell, artist and writer who teaches at Stanford University. Her new book is called How to Do Nothing, Resisting the Attention Economy. In the wake of Special Counsel Robert Mueller's report, many pointed to the possibility that President Trump could be charged with a crime after leaving office. Mueller himself appeared to allude to that, stating in his report that the president does not have immunity after he leaves office. But how would the charging and prosecution of a former president work? And are there any historical examples of that happening? Jens David Olien is an expert in criminal law and professor and vice dean of the Cornell Law School. Jens, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
Well, as we heard in the Mueller report, at least by the Department of Justice guidelines, a sitting president can't be charged with crimes. They have to be dealt with by Congress or not at all, I guess. Does a former president enjoy any special protections like that?
He or she doesn't. So Trump or any other president could be prosecuted once they leave office. That would happen by an indictment by the Justice Department that would have to be pursued by the next administration, the next attorney general, the next, you know, U.S. attorney or, you know, whichever division of the Justice Department decided to pursue a criminal case against Trump. There's all sorts of, you know, issues and obstacles relating to that. But I think the major sort of pragmatic question would be whether or not the next administration was interested in looking backwards and pursuing criminal accountability for Trump, or whether or not they decided that they should just let the past fade into the distance and try and, you know, bring healing to the country by sort of forgetting this whole unfortunate incident.
Have we seen cases in the past where a president, once out of office, was seen as likely to be subject to criminal charges? I guess Richard Nixon was pardoned by Gerald Ford, if you want to talk about that or other comparable examples.
Right. Nixon certainly anticipated that he might get prosecuted or indicted and was worried enough about it. So Ford pardoned him, and that's why Nixon was never prosecuted. Tough to know whether or not Nixon would have been prosecuted, but there certainly was substantial evidence that was developed during the Watergate investigation. So that's why he was never prosecuted. And in fact, the whole point of the Ford pardon is a recognition of the fact that a president can be indicted, because If a former president couldn't be indicted and prosecuted, then there would be no reason for Ford to have pardoned Nixon. The other good example, which is not a precedent, is Spiro Agnew. He was vice president, and he was forced to resign. And although he wasn't sent to prison or anything like that, his resignation came about as a plea bargain in resolution of a criminal case. That one is a slightly different because no one contends that a vice president is completely immune from prosecution. You know, and the other example, which I think is interesting to put on the table, is, again, not one of presidential immunity, but it was Obama's decision not to pursue criminal cases against members of the Bush administration who were involved in the torture of Al-Qaeda and other, you know, detainees during the war on terror. And there was a substantial push to, you know, investigate and bring prosecutions against members of the Bush administration. And Obama made this decision that he thought that was a bad idea, that we needed to look forward, and ultimately decided that there wasn't going to be any criminal prosecutions.
We're talking to Jens David Olien from Cornell Law School about possible prosecutions of presidents after they leave office. Focusing on President Trump, what kind of charges could he hypothetically be vulnerable to on the federal level after leaving office from what we know now?
I think the two most obvious ones would be obstruction of justice related to the information that Mueller outlined in his report. As you recall, there was, you know, one half of the report was basically about obstruction of justice. And Mueller laid out 10 specific examples or factual events that constituted or may have constituted obstruction of justice. So in terms of the Russia investigation, I think that would be the most likely source of a criminal indictment against Trump. And then the other possibility would be non-Russia investigation related criminal offenses that are either developed, you know, now by the Justice Department, by divisions outside of Mueller's investigation, or by other Justice Department divisions after Trump leaves office. I mean, it's possible that the information that Michael Cohen provided to prosecutors, information about financial dealings, potential fraud related to loan applications, et cetera, any number of those could possibly, or at least in theory, yield an indictment in the future against Trump.
Now, who would be the decider under a future administration after a president leaves office? Would this be something that would have to be decided by the attorney general, or could an individual federal prosecutor decide to pursue something? Where would something like that be decided?
All of the above. So an individual prosecutor would be in charge of developing the case. So either a U.S. attorney in a particular district, like the U.S. attorney for the Southern District of New York, or federal prosecutor in charge of a particular division. For example, they have a specific division that deals with corruption for politicians, and the federal prosecutor in charge of that could start the case. But then it would have to be approved by not just the attorney general, but various deputy attorney generals in between those two individuals. And in theory, it may even have to go to the sitting president. So that's the thing, that ultimately there's no way around the fact that it would be partly a political decision in the sense that the attorney general himself or herself would have to authorize this prosecution. And in doing so, I think they would be looking at a lot of different factors. So on the one hand, they would be asking a very lawyerly question, which is, well, how much evidence is there? Is there enough evidence to suggest that Donald Trump committed a crime and that a trial is warranted? But then they would also be asking some more vague questions like, is this a useful pursuit for the Department of Justice? Is it helpful for the cause of justice? Is it important for the country that we do this? And I think that's where things get very complicated and messy, because there's arguments on both sides. One argument is that really there needs to be accountability for past wrongdoing, but then there's also difficult questions about how we heal and move forward and try and sort of reclaim a sense of national unity.
When you mentioned hypothetical charges that could be filed, you mentioned obstruction of justice, which is something that happened while President Trump was president. You also mentioned some things that happened during the campaign before he was president. Do those two categories look different in the eyes of the law? Actions taken by a sitting president, actions taken by someone before they became president?
To a certain degree, yes, and to a certain degree, no. So they're the same in the sense that there's no immunity for actions that are performed while in office. So Trump doesn't have any kind of presidential immunity. It's not as if by being president, he's immune from prosecution after he leaves office, you know, in the sense that everything he does is shielded from criminal accountability. That's certainly not the case. And so in that sense, whether he committed the crime during the campaign or committed the crime during office, the law doesn't care about that distinction. On the other hand, the one thing that does make things a little bit different is that actions that he engaged in during the presidency could potentially be defended as a matter of law with a constitutional argument that his behavior was part of his constitutional purview. Now, I certainly don't accept that argument. I think it's a very dangerous argument to start saying, well, the president can do X, Y, and Z because he's commander in chief and he's pursuing his duties under Article 2 of the Constitution. I think that's a very dangerous argument. But I think it would be naive to think that Trump wouldn't raise that argument. I'm sure that because, you know, for example, Giuliani and other lawyers who work for Trump have certainly said as much many times. So I think if he was prosecuted for obstruction of justice or other things he did while in office, they would be raising this argument that these actions are protected by his constitutional authority.
Jens, as we wrap up, I won't ask you to predict the future here, but from what you're saying, it seems like we've set a pretty high bar for what it would take to want to prosecute a former president, and we haven't jumped over that bar yet.
Yeah, it's tough to predict exactly what's going to happen, and I think, you know, sort of part of this depends on what happens with the impeachment dilemma that the Democrats in Congress face right now. And technically, as a legal matter, the two aren't linked. So regardless of whether or not Trump is impeached or not, or whether or not he's simply voted out of the ballot box, voted out of office in the next election, either way, he could be subject to criminal prosecution. But the reason why I link the two is that impeachment in the House, even if he's not removed in the Senate, may quench a thirst for accountability that many people have. It might be precisely the kind of signal that people want, which is an official statement that there was wrongdoing here. And I wonder if there is an impeachment in the House, whether or not that will blunt some of the desire for a criminal prosecution, because people will feel like, hey, we've had accountability. We've had that labeling associated with his conduct.
Jens, thanks a lot for joining us today.
You're very welcome.
That was Jens David Olien, an expert in criminal law and professor and vice dean of the Cornell Law School. He's with us today to break down what charging a president after he or she leaves office might look like and how this has been resolved in the past. The police standoff in Oconomowoc that began on Tuesday lasted 12 hours, shut down part of I-94, and at one point turned into a hostage situation before two suspects fled a stolen minivan and were apprehended. Both were hospitalized but are in stable condition. That incident was streamed live on Facebook by one of the suspects as she was being held at gunpoint by the other person in the vehicle. Many other situations involving police or ongoing crimes have been streamed live on social media. Some cases, those events have included violence and death. To raise questions about where and how social media companies should draw the line on letting users broadcast potentially violent or hateful content. Steve Knoll is a marketing professor and social media expert at Madison College. Steve, welcome back to Central Time.
Great. Thanks for having me.
Well, we see a lot of different live streaming alternatives from Facebook that everybody knows, Twitch for people to broadcast games, among other things. What's the goal? What are social media companies hoping to get out of making this possible for their users?
Well, the whole idea with live streaming is to build engagement. People love to see live. You think about like football games on TV, watching concerts on TV. TV. There's something about real time that gets people excited, gets them engaged. And that's what social media is about, is building engagement. So they started, you know, experimenting with live streaming. Twitter actually started with an app called Periscope. And the problem was, is it was before we really had unlimited data plans, and it was a big data crunch, and Periscope never really surfaced. But now, of course, Facebook Live, that's their the big platform right now. And the idea is to really see what's happening in real time to other people. But, of course, as soon as someone starts using it for good, someone figures out how to use it for bad.
Right. We've seen, I think the worst case, probably the Christchurch mosque shooting in New Zealand earlier this year, streamed live on Facebook. On Twitch, a shooting at an e-sport event was broadcast live on Twitch. Did social media companies go into this thinking, hey, we got to monitor to make sure really bad stuff isn't being sent out on our airwaves, quote unquote?
Yeah. What do you call it? Yeah. So, but yeah, that's the thing that every social media company is concerned of. The problem is live, you know, that when something goes out live, it's instant. It's happening live. And how do you know if it's good content or bad content? And certainly there are computers, there's artificial intelligence and algorithms, but even that is still limited in the amount of time. In the case of the Christchurch shootings, it was about 20 minutes before everything got shut down and pulled. And by then, that was just a horrific amount of violence that was seen. And so that is a problem with these companies, is how to moderate live. Even live television isn't really live. If you watch like an award show, it's about 10 seconds delayed because they realize people swear. And now when you watch it, there's about a 10-second delay. But that's a single broadcast. When you think about a Facebook live stream, you're talking about potentially millions of people starting their own broadcast at the same second. And how can a company monitor every last one of them?
How are they trying? You mentioned some artificial intelligence.
Yeah, a lot of it is using AI.
And there are rooms full of people, right, that are trying to monitor content on Facebook.
Right. It starts with the AI. It's they've got the computers that are looking for content within the data stream that can be flagged. And the AI is kind of the first step to flag it. And then if there's something that's questionable, it gets escalated to a human. But again, by the time it gets through that chain, you're talking seconds, if not minutes, before that person can, you know, get the stream, take a look at it, and analyze as to what is the context of what is being streamed. A lot of it is context. If we just started a live stream right from something, it would probably take you 30 seconds to really figure out what is the reasoning, who is this, and you don't want to jump to conclusions, because then you're getting into censorship issues. You're getting into the idea of who are the censors, and a lot of the live stream, you know, on the negative, you know, people who have been arrested, especially people of color, have turned to live streaming as a way to document, you know, bad things happening to them. And obviously, if they just turn on a stream and you see something going on, how long does it take before you figure out, oh, this is somebody just acting out a play?
We're talking to Steve Knoll from Madison College, marketing professor and social media expert there, looking at live streaming, bad stuff that goes out on it, crimes, violent killing sprees even, and how social media companies try to figure out how to monitor that and what should and shouldn't be going on over their live streams. Steve, on your way into the studio, you mentioned there's some new news here from Apple, a new app that is very relevant to the story. Can you talk about that?
It's an app. It's a shortcut. So, yeah, it's a shortcut. And it's actually called Police. And what it is you would download it, install it on your phone using Siri. And say, for example, you are being pulled over by the police. You can just say, Siri, I'm being arrested. And it'll trigger Siri to do two things. Number one, we'll shoot out a text to a predetermined person with a message saying, you know, I am being pulled over. And then it'll also start the recording on it. So it'll start the front-facing camera and start doing a live recording, and then it'll archive that into Dropbox. So even if something happens to your phone, if your phone's destroyed, the actual recording will still be in the cloud. And this is something they've just rolled out in the last few days.
Now, I know there's lots of laws in the state about recording,
and
it's different from state to state.
Yes, it is.
Who has to consent to that? I don't know if a police officer as a public official can deny consent. I don't know. It's going to raise a lot of interesting legal issues.
It is.
Because you could use it not with a police person present.
Yeah,
too.
And that's the problem with technology, is a lot of times these situations have to go to a court case. And then that will establish precedent as to whether or not this type of recording or video can be admissible or not. So that's the problem with technology. It's always a Wild West frontier. You try all this stuff, and some stuff will eventually be determined as being illegal. Some stuff will be legal. Some stuff will stay in that gray area. That's just the nature of new technology.
Now, you can see a government, maybe with good intentions, maybe mm-hmm. not wanting to have the ability to stop something like, say, the live streaming of a Christchurch shooting
sure.
kind of event.
Sure.
You could see them using exactly that same ability for a lot of bad reasons, too.
Exactly. You know, if people are doing a legal protest, you know, what could stop a government from, you know, shutting down, you know, turning off Facebook or Twitter? We've seen this in other countries when there have been uprising, and the first thing they do is they turn off Twitter. You know, Twitter is, you know, so much about what's happening in the actual moment. And we've seen that in country after country when there's been a big political movement. The first thing the opposing government does is shuts down social media access.
Is this a case where social media put out this this feature, in this case, mm-hmm. live streaming,
mm-hmm.
and didn't really think ahead on what people were actually going to do with it?
Well, yes and no. This kind of goes back to this whole theory that I have that a lot of people, especially with Facebook, is they go into a lot of this stuff thinking that people are genuinely good people. And I think most are. But, you know, again, they put this out there thinking that people use it for good, and then they just wait and cross their fingers that nothing bad will happen. Well, of course, something eventually will happen that's bad. I mean, you look at live streaming, you know, things of like, you know, a birthday party and, you know, other members of the family can see it live, you know, all over the world. This is a wonderful thing that didn't exist 10 years ago. It's really, really neat. They're live streaming weddings and funerals and things that are very emotional that you want to have that real-time connection with and you just don't have because of geography. So there's so many wonderful things about live streaming, but of course, there's a dark side to it, and certainly somebody will always find a way to use it for a bad reason.
That reminds me, there's more new news on this. I just saw a little while ago YouTube now
yep.
Trying to crack down on the ability of under 12s,
yep, good
kids
luck.
Under 12, to live
that,
stream.
That's a good example of how do you determine that, because say that a 10-year-old turns on the YouTube Live app and starts live streaming. How long will it take before somebody at YouTube determines, oh, this kid is on their own and they need to have a parent, we need to cut the stream? How long is that going to be? Are we talking seconds? Are we talking minutes? Are we talking hours? That's a very good question to see how this rolls out.
In our last minute or so, Steve, what are some of the frontiers you're watching for of the issues we'll be dealing with live streaming?
Part of it is are we going to move to a point where it's going to be live with delay, like what they do with television, that you'll start a live stream, but it won't actually post to social media for, say, 30 seconds. And that 30 seconds will allow at least a computer to scan it and see if there's an objectionable content. At that point, is it really live video anymore? That's a big question, is live live?
Right. And if you're on Twitch, you want people commenting on what you're doing right now,
in real time,
not 30 seconds ago.
Yes, because then they can be reacting to what is happening in the moment. I mean, nobody's going to watch a football game knowing that, you know, somebody's going to find out if that they got that touchdown 30 seconds ago, because the other person, you know, listening to it on the radio already found out what's happening.
We'll leave it there for now. Steve, thanks as always for joining us.
Great. Thank you.
That's Steve Knoll, marketing professor and social media expert at Madison College. He's with us to talk about users live streaming crimes or other dangerous situations or events on different online platforms and how companies are responding. You can let us know what you think about all this. Should users be able to live stream content on social media? They can, of course. What sort of policies do you want to see in place at the companies, the YouTubes and the Facebooks and the Twitches of the world, to make sure bad stuff isn't out there? Let us know. Now, when you order food at a restaurant or you're getting takeout, do you ask them to hold the onions? If so, you're not alone. The food reporting website, thetakeout.com, reported on data collected by Uber Eats on the most common special order requests. So this is when, if you do this sort of thing, you order from a restaurant and then Uber brings it. So they looked at the special twists on orders and found out some of the most common special order requests. Number one on that list is hold the onions. No onions. A lot of people didn't want this. And this, in the comment section there, got some controversy. I can see this. I like onions. They don't like me as much as I get older. And sometimes those raw onions can really overpower the sandwich or whatever. So I can see that. Number two, extra sauce. Pretty straightforward. Number three, and this I think was the most controversial one on the whole list, no tomatoes. There are a lot of people feeling passionately pro or con tomatoes. I think it's a seasonal thing. We're in a place where sometimes that winter tomato slice on a sandwich, not so great. That fresh tomato slice could be the sandwich all by itself in the middle of summer. Some of the other special requests we see a lot, no sour cream. What? You always want sour cream, right? Spicy. People sometimes want it spicier. No cheese. They didn't survey Wisconsin, I guess. And extra ranch. Ranch is all the rage amongst the kids. A lot of special requests coming up here on Central Time. You're listening to the Ideas Network.